for Natural Resources for the Joint Committee on Ways and Means to order, and would open the public hearing on House Bill 5018, Department of Environmental Quality. Mr. Siebert, do we have any updates before we start the hearing today?
Mr. Chair, at your place, you'll have a response from the department on questions that were asked yesterday. Place on top of your budget book, and I'm sure as you have a chance to look through this, the department would be willing to fill in any further information.
Thank you. I'd like to call Stephanie Halleck forward. Stephanie, would you like to maybe go over this briefly with us, what we have here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Stephanie Halleck, the Director of the Department of Environmental Quality, and in this memo, we have attempted to respond to some of the questions that you raised yesterday. The first question had to do with how we measure the quality of the water and whether or not it's improving or declining. And we have attached a list of monitoring sites. Representative Krieger, I believe, asked how many of the sites with declining water quality were on the coast, and none of them, as you will see, are. There are in the Powder Burnt River Basin, there are some in the McKinsey River watershed as well. And we've also identified in the second paragraph of the narrative there the types of parameters that we monitor for, which was also a question that the committee had. The second question that was asked had to do with, of the emergency response calls that come into DEQ and to the Oregon Emergency Response System, how many of those do we actually have to act on? And as we've indicated here, we have to check out all of the calls in some way to ascertain the validity. Some of that can be done by telephone to local responders, and then we've given you some numbers here on the actual ones that we have to go out on that either involve a confirmed release of a hazardous material or require us to be involved for some other reason. And that's the response to the second question.
Stephanie, excuse me. Am I reading this right then? Of the 2,358 calls, only 666 were... Doesn't sound right. I must be reading it wrong.
No, Senator, I think you're reading it correctly. What this tells you is that fortunately, since we don't have a large budget and a large staff, we are able to follow up a lot by phone, email, whatever, with local first responders or the complainants or wherever the call comes in without actually having to go out. So these numbers you see in the next three bullets indicate the numbers that we actually have to get involved in. The one thing that I would point out, though, as you can see from the last bullet, that kind of gives you a sense, the 74 days of some cases, some of these incidents require, New Carissa is obviously a huge example where you're involved for weeks on end. Others are just a matter of hours or sometimes a matter of days.
I would assume it would be a conclusion also that the public is very aware and is very vigilant in calling in.
Absolutely. That's correct, Senator. On the next page, there was a question from Senator Dukes with regard to the rate at which we were adding contaminated sites to our cleanup workload. And what we've indicated here, in 2002, we added a total of 191 sites. 133 were underground storage tank facilities, and 58 were cleanup sites of other hazardous substances. And we've also attached, following the listing of the monitoring sites, a chart from 99 through 2002 of contaminated site trends in Oregon and how many we have added. There was a large blip in 1999 of tank sites that were added because there was a 1998 deadline for reporting those, and so we had a whole bunch come in 99, and then as you can see, it's dropped off some since then. But there's still a relative steady rate of sites that do get added to the system. I believe that both you and Representative Krieger had asked about the locations of the closed landfills and the leaking landfills, and we've also attached a list of those, and they are organized starting with the leaking landfills. Then we, and those are municipal solid waste landfills, followed by the leaking industrial landfills or sludge sites. Then we have a list also of the landfills that are closed but are not known to be leaking at this time. And Senator, you had asked a question about a particular case, I guess, that one of your constituents had on a prospective purchaser agreement, and the fact that it didn't seem to work very well because there was not known contamination at that site. And that is correct. That particular tool, the prospective purchaser agreement program, and the statute is cited there as being very specific to cleanup of contaminated property. So it really does not fit very well. And we've gone on to explain a couple of other potential alternatives, but that could very well be a gap in the system.
Stephanie, would that take legislative action, or could you handle that with an administrative rule?
Well, in my read of the statutory language here, it's pretty clear that it would probably take some change to the statute to make it clear that other sites could be candidates.
I would be very open if your department could kind of draft up a concept of either getting through committee or some way getting some kind of a bill into. Better clarify that.
Senator, we'd be happy to do that, and I will also ask my staff to take a look and make sure it isn't something we could do by rule or policy rather than have to do that. But if it does take statute change, we'd be happy to work with you.
And I hate to put any more pressure on you, but if we're going to get it done this year, we need to move. We've got roughly another month yet of committees being open. So
I understand. We'll get right on it.
Okay.
Representative Johnson asked a question about how we ensure that the counties who administer the on-site septic tank program are consistent in how they do that. We've explained the goal of how we try and work with the counties to make sure that they are consistent. The way the statute and the rules are written, they are supposed to be, although we've also gone on to explain that different agents can and do interpret rules in different ways, and so we always have to be vigilant about that. I think what would probably be a good idea is, this gives you sort of the general principles of how it's supposed to work, but I think we need to follow up offline with both Senator Dukes and Representative Johnson, because these two counties of concern are in their district, and I think they may have some specific issues that they're concerned about.
How many counties do you have that administer their own?
We're split. I think the 36 counties are now split roughly evenly. What generally happens, we've been in a protracted discussion with most recently with Douglas County, where they were interested in, we have been running the program in Douglas County presently. In the past, they have run it. They were interested in taking it back, and now they've decided not to take it back. It's generally an economic concern, mostly. If a county feels, the statute is very clear that the county is only allowed to collect enough revenue off of the program to fund the program. In other words, they're not to use that revenue for other activities. So obviously they have to have enough business in the county to make it worth it for them to take it. So most of the counties where we still administer the program are in Eastern Oregon. They're very sparsely populated. They don't have that many sites, and they really can't afford to take the program. One of my goals is for us to, and we're working with an advisory committee, as you know, to try and figure out what we could do either in statute change or funding or whatever it would take to make it easier for some of those counties to band together, perhaps, and they could share a sanitarian. And maybe work multi-county, something like that, so there'd be more of an incentive to do it, because I really do believe that a program like this is best delivered as close to the constituents as possible. There's an interesting side thing going on. I've been talking to Mike McCallum in the Restaurant Association. It's often true in the counties that the same people who do the inspections, the food inspections, are the ones who they're registered sanitarians, and they do the septic work. And they actually, on that side of the shop, are having some dissatisfaction with the consistency, and they are wanting to pull back some of those authorities to the state. You know, my goal, of course, is to push them back out. So I've shared with Mike our statutes and rules and how we've tried to build consistency in the on-site program so we could hopefully not be working at cross purposes on this.
And I see you're working on our standards compared to others, to the feds and other states.
Yes, I apologize. I omitted that. That's going to take a little bit of research on our part to respond to that question about stringency.
I'm going to make one more request at this point. And we're not picking on DEQ because we've asked other departments to do the same thing. And that would be if you could give us a summary of all the funds you have within your department, and what is the balance in those funds, and what are the restrictions or the dedication? Are those funds dedicated?
Are those, Senator, are those the ending balances that you're requesting, or should we just work with Paul? Okay.
Well, that's a good question, because last report I looked at, it was what is in the account right now, and then it tried to allow for what would be in the ending balance. I think it would be more better information if it was the ending balance, and then because that's really what we're looking for.
We'll be happy to do that. We'll work with Paul on that.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Stephanie.
All right, Mr. Chairman. I would like to ask Holly Schroeder to come to the table, and she is going to walk you through the response to the third question that the co-chairs asked, which is how the agency uses its budget. And she is going to just give you a very straightforward presentation on the numbers and how the numbers work and where they are.
And Stephanie and Holly, let me note for the record that Senator Dukes is excused today. So, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Holly Schroeder. I work in the budget office at DEQ. And I just have a handful of slides continuing where Director Halleck left off in response to the co-chair's third question about how the agency uses its budget. This begins on page 16 of your handout, slide 16. And some of this is information that was presented by Paul or Lisa, some of it was over to review, so I won't belabor those points too much. The first slide that we have shows our overall budget, and as you can see, the agency's the governor's balanced budget for the agency is a total of $273 million. DEQ receives its budget by program. That is a new development from the 2001-03 session. So you can see the pollution control programs that the agency administers, the air quality, water quality, and land quality being the primary pollution control programs of the agency. The little sliver that you see there that's called cross-media is actually a budget structure that we use, and I'll explain what that is. We don't have an organizational unit called cross-media, but it's a budget mechanism that we created a few years back, and I'll elaborate on why we have that in a couple of minutes. And then the agency management program is our director's office and infrastructure support for the agency at 7.4% of the total agency budget. The two slices of the pie there that are pulled out, the one down at the bottom right is the debt service, which we have debt service for the agency at just over 5% of the total budget. We sell pollution control bonds for the orphan site program, which is for cleanup of contaminated lands that don't have a clear responsible party. And also for the state revolving fund program, which is we sell bonds in order to match federal capitalization money for that program. We sell $1 for every dollar of state funds, we leverage $5 of federal funds. And then that goes up into the next pie up there, that revolving fund loan. And that's a loan program out to municipalities for the construction and upgrade of wastewater treatment plants. It's a revolving loan program that we infuse new capitalization money from the feds into each biennium. And we revolve a loan out to the municipalities for them to do their wastewater treatment plant upgrades, and then they repay those loans. It goes back into the revolving fund and then can be loaned out to other communities. So it's a revolving fund in that way.
What percentage of those funds are loaned out? Have your capacity on those funds?
We loan out, we are projecting to loan out about $100 million in the 03-05 biennium. The revolving fund program is actually called part of our non-limited budget. And so as you turn to the next slide, you see what we call our operating budget, which also excludes the debt service from it. So those two pieces of the pie that are kind of pulled aside are things that we exclude from the definition of operating budget. Now, when Paul gave his overview yesterday, we had a brief discussion about sort of what you call operating. And Paul accorded a number of $189 million for operating. We consider that our limited budget, which is what we receive limitation for, and that includes debt service. We exclude the debt service from our what we consider to be our operating budget because the debt service and the state revolving fund can't be used for actual agency operations. So this, what you're seeing here on this slide on page 17, is what we can actually use for agency operations, and that comes to a total of $179 million. So the slide on the right shows the two views you have here. The slide on the right shows a similar view to the previous one broken out by program, and the one on the left shows that to you by fund type. As you can see, we have just under 14% general fund, and that we're predominantly reliant on other funds. That's mostly fees and cost recovery. And there's a variety of different fees, all of which have dedicated work that goes along with those, as are dedicated to certain work. And then we also receive federal money in order to support implementation of federal programs, and those also come with dedicated work plans as part of them. On the following slide, I show a breakout of how we use the general and lottery funds within the agency. And this is the entire amount of general and lottery funds in the agency, just under $35 million. You can see that almost a third, 30% of the general lottery fund in the agency goes to debt service, and that's debt service on those bonds that I mentioned for orphan site cleanup and for the state revolving fund loan program. And over half of the general lottery funds in the agency goes into the water quality program, 51% of that. And then the remainder is split between the other pollution control programs. What I'm going to do now is just walk through each of the budgets for each of the programs in the agency. As I indicated, we receive the budget by program, and so I just thought I'd walk through that and illustrate a couple of points to you in each of those budgets. The air quality operating budget is the budget where we house our funding for several programs, including our air quality permitting, our air pollution permitting programs, including the Title V federal permitting program and the state air contaminant discharge permitting program. It also includes the vehicle inspection program and our statewide air quality monitoring network, as well as our efforts to reduce pollution from some smaller sources, including asbestos and gas stations and other small area sources. You can see that it's largely reliant on other funds. Over three-quarters of it comes from fees. This is because a couple of the sub-programs in this area are budgeted entirely by fees. The federal Title V program is required by federal rule to be 100% fee-based, and in addition, the vehicle inspection program is also 100% supported by fees. Turning then to the water quality program, the water quality program being just slightly larger than the air quality program at $48 million. And this, you can see here that this has a more balanced mix of funding here between the three fund types of federal, other, and general. This program includes our efforts to develop and implement total maximum daily loads, our monitoring network around the state, our permitting programs for wastewater and stormwater, our on-site septic system, as well as the grant program that we administer for non-point source pollution control, which is called the 319 program. And you can see that actually nearly 10% of the budget in the water quality program is actually given out in grants as a part of that program, $4.7 million. In the land quality program is where we implement our solid and hazardous waste management and disposal efforts, the underground tank program, environmental cleanup of contaminated sites, and our emergency response and spills response. This program is largely dependent on fees. You can see there's a very small sliver of general fund in this program. It is very fee dependent. You'll also see that the wedge there for the federal looks fairly substantial, and the majority of that goes to two primary projects. One is the destruction of weapons out at the Umatilla Army Depot, as well as the cleanup of the McCormick and Baxter Superfund site. So 67% of that federal wedge is used for those two projects exclusively. And then I put the last two programs on the same slide, since they are smaller in comparison to the individual pollution control programs. The first one is this little tiny wedge called cross media. And for us, by the term media, we mean program. So it's a cross program. And this is a budget structure that we set up two or three biennia ago. At that time, we saw an increase in federal funding, especially, that didn't discreetly fit into one of the pollution control program budgets, and we thought that it would be better to have that in its own budget unit and could be more identifiable and tracked. An example of this is the pollution prevention in states grant that we received, and we received that grant in order to work on pollution prevention projects such as ones that are for a distinct industry sector. So we would work with that sector for pollution prevention in all areas, air pollution, water pollution, as well as waste generation. And so rather than parsing that out into the program budgets, we created this structure in order to make those funds more trackable. We did that a few biennia ago. It turns out that those grants are not becoming as numerous. We thought that was the beginning of a trend towards increasing grants of that nature. It doesn't seem to be the case at this point, so we will be evaluating whether we want to continue this budget structure in future budgets. And then the final program is the agency management program, which, as I indicated earlier, is our agency director's office, as well as our infrastructure, our financial management of our budget office and our accounting office, our human resources management, as well as our information systems management. The agency management program is funded by a surcharge on the program personal services, and then that money is transferred into the agency management program, so it is 99% other funds. And then I wanted to give a snapshot of what has happened in over time to our budget during the interim. So you can see on this chart that there is where we were at the close of the 2001 session, where we stand as of special session 6, and then what is included in the governor's balanced budget for DEQ. And you can see that the total budget for the agency has gone from $304 million, and then the governor's balanced budget is $273 million. Our general fund lottery fund has dropped from $43 million to just under $35 million. And our FTE has dropped from 865 FTE to 821. The FTE drop is largely due to the special session reductions. That accounts for over 30 of the FTE. The remainder are due to a variety of programs that either scaled down or phased out, and we did not ask to have those positions restored.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
How many of these were of the loss of personnel were taken up by vacancies or position shifts, and how many are actually out of the agency at this point?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, if I may clarify the question, this is an actual FTE loss to the agency. We as an agency have been very conservative in our personnel management.
That's what I should have asked.
And as a result, we have not had to lay off any employees at this point. We have had a couple of separations of limited duration employees as well as, and we've moved people from one type of work and reassigned them into vacancies. But at this point, we have not had to do any layoffs.
Thank you for more artfully phrasing my awkward question.
Representative Krieger.
Chair, most agencies are having people leave because of PERS and early retirements and that type of thing. Where are you at on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, we also are seeing an increase in the number of retirements in the agency. We have estimated that, let me see if I can pull up the numbers. We've estimated that, I believe it is somewhere in the order of 20% of our employees are eligible for retirement. We've not seen numbers that high actually filing and giving separation dates, but that's people who... who by the rules are could qualify if they would choose to.
But you have had some that have left, and what you got 20% of let and that'd be 160, and then you got another 10, 15, 20 that maybe through the natural process you'd lose that many, and this year it's escalated faster because of concerns. I just wondered how many that number might be, and are those open slots, or have you moved people around prioritizing those holes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, it's a combination of both, and I can get you the actual numbers on how many retirements we have had to date at this point. We do have some vacancies as a result of both natural attrition as well as retirements. And in some cases, we have used those vacancies to house people who would otherwise be looking at a layoff in order to avoid the layoff procedures, which are complicated in their own right. And we so we can get you, but we can get the exact numbers for you if you'd like.
Helpful. Thanks. Okay.
Just a couple of points that just to leave you with on the budget. The on page 24 here, our budget is $273 million, but I'd like to provide the context to people of that, of recognizing that a substantial amount of that is actually passed on to other organizations. We talked about the near 30% that is loaned out to municipalities for wastewater treatments. We talked about, I mentioned the water quality grants, and when you total all of that up, it is 40% of our budget that is sent to other organizations. Our budget is has a heavy reliance on other funds, is 73% of the total budget is other funds. We receive our budget by program, and it has a large within that those other funds by so the program authorizes us to spend money within a program and cannot be moved between programs. And then within that, we have a large number of dedicated funds that have specified uses. For each of those different accounts that we need to manage independently. And with that, that was all I was going to present on the budget, unless you have any questions. Otherwise, I will turn it back to Director Halleck.
Any questions from the committee? Thank you.
Thank you, Holly. I'm on page 25, and we're about to move into the final question from the co-chairs, what results can be expected from our budget. And what we're going to do now is walk through with you in some detail each of the programs, and I'll have each of the program administrators assist in doing that. You might want to refer to the list in Appendix A04 of Tab 4, which is the list of all the policy packages, and the administrators will probably also refer you to other pages in the binder as they talk about their individual programs. Very quickly, I will refresh your memory on these packages. You might want to make some notes just on that sheet. Again, we have developed our budget to help achieve our strategic directions and performance measures, to support our legislative priorities that you see on this page here, and to continue progress in customer service and process improvements that I discussed with you yesterday. The policy packages that are listed on Appendix A04 packages 081, 090, 091, and 092 are budget adjustments and reductions. Packages 101, 102, 103, and 104 are ratifications of fees approved by the legislature last session, and the accompanying legislation for those is Senate Bill 197. I believe you have copies of that.
Representative Morgan.
The back up to the packages that begin with a zero. The 5100 budget adjustments were under Measure 28 going down, I take it.
Representative Morgan, Holly Schroeder is going to come back to the table and assist me with this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, yes, the package 91 is the carry forward of the Measure 28 reductions.
Okay, and then package 092 is the November revenue forecast reductions.
The 092 is an additional reduction that we took as part of the governor's balanced budget. We had, in working with the Department of Administrative Services and crafting it, they did look for additional reductions in order to bring the entire governor's budget into balance, and they took an additional reduction out of our budget a little over $2.083 million, and that was to self-finance the debt on the state revolving fund. And using the interest and fee payments that we receive back from municipalities to pay the debt service as opposed to using general or lottery funds for that.
So was package 092 an operation on the 0103 budget or the 0305 budget?
That, Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, that is a reduction for 0305.
Okay. So all of these are the first. The 081, 090, and 091 are continuing cuts that were made to 0103, and 092 are cuts that are particular to 0305 to rebalance to the governor's funding level.
That is correct, Representative.
Thank you.
I won't even pretend that I could have done that. Just briefly going on the summary, Mr. Chair, packages, as I said, 101, 102, 103, and 104 are fee ratifications. I know that both Paul and Lisa have covered this, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, and I believe you have Senate Bill 197 in your materials. Package 120 is a general fund package which would continue the development of the Willamette Basin total maximum daily loads through the end of this calendar year. Packages 122 and 123 are continuations of federal funds for implementing TMDLs and also our drinking water protection program. Packages 112, 125, 136, 143, and 151 also continue existing federal grants, and they add some more federal resources in several different programs. Those packages are across.
Mr. Chair, could I ask you to do those? Ask her to do those one more time.
I would be happy to do that. 112, 125, 136, 143, and 151. They are all federal. They either continue federal grants, and in a couple of instances, they are new federal grants. And when we get into the specific detail in a moment, we'll go through that. I'd be happy to back up on the others if I've been racing through this.
I think we got the other.
Is 122 also part of that?
122 and 123, yes, they are both. We tried to do these sort of in chronological order, which probably doesn't make much sense, but they are also both federal. They should be in that group of continuation of federal funds.
If I might, Mr. Chair, the drinking water protection program 123 has an other funds component to it. Why other funds rather than federal funds?
Mr. Chair and Representative Morgan, if you will indulge me until we bring the programs up, we can get in detail if that's okay with you. I was just trying to give you a quick summary, which may not have been a good idea, but we will get in great detail on those funding sources in just a second. The next group of packages are fee funded, and that is 113, 124, 129, 131, and 152. And as was pointed out yesterday by Paul and Lisa, package 131 is the only one in there that is dependent on a fee increase. And the accompanying legislation is Senate Bill 196, which I believe you also have.
What was the last program in the fees?
The last package was 152. Package 192 is the actual state revolving fund bond sale itself, and 191 is the package for the debt service. Package 180 reduces general fund and lottery from DEQ's budget and transfers that to the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board for the Lower Columbia River Estuary Project. Packages 165 and 167 are activities in agency management and, as Holly explained, are funded on the indirect surcharge. Packages 171, 172, and 173 are the share of general fund that each program must contribute to fund an increase in the rent for our laboratory space that we discussed yesterday briefly. And then finally, just so you have all the packages accounted for, 133, 150, 166, 193, and 194 were not funded in the governor's balanced budget. And I'd like to now move into going over this in some detail so we can get all your questions answered. And we'll begin with
this is really
your
useful.
Question. Good. I'm glad. Thank you. And Andy Ginsberg, the Administrator of the Air Quality Program, will help out.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator of DEQ. I was asked to give a short overview of the Air Quality Program. Is that still your desire?
Sure.
Okay. If I could refer you to our handout on tab 5 in the presentation notebook, that's where air quality begins. And let me start by saying that our purpose of our air quality program is to provide healthy and clean air for all Oregonians. And you can see under that there are three goals for the air quality program. And I'm just going to walk down through those briefly because those really encompass everything we do in the air quality program. The first goal is attaining and maintaining the federal ambient air quality standards to protect public health and accommodate growth. That really accounts for the bulk of what we do. And as you heard in presentations yesterday, we've had a great success in that area. We now have 100% of Oregonians living in areas where air meets the federal ambient air quality standards. And that's also Oregon benchmark number 75, which is on page 6 of tab 5. But this wasn't always the case. We had in the 1970s and the 1980s, we had quite a few areas that were exceeding the federal air quality standards. In fact, in the mid-70s, we had something like 360 exceedances of the federal standards every year. Now we're down to an occasional exceedance, not enough to violate the standard, but an occasional exceedance. Three of the federal standards were the ones that have given us the most trouble over the years, particulate, ozone, which is also smog, and carbon monoxide are the three that we've worked the most on. For particulate, we've had seven areas that have violated the standards in the past. That's Eugene, Springfield, Oak Ridge, Grants Pass, Medford, Ashland, Klamath Falls, the Grand, Lakeview. And Medford actually was the worst particulate non-attainment area in the entire country with the most number of days violating the standard. For ozone, we had three areas, Portland, Salem, and Medford. And then for carbon monoxide, we had six areas, Portland, Salem, Eugene, Springfield, Grants Pass, Medford, and Klamath Falls. All of those areas are now meeting the air quality standards, and that's due to the air quality attainment plans that we adopted in the 1980s and the early 1990s. So I want to just tell you briefly about our two-step process. The first step is that we put together an attainment plan that's designed to take the area from not meeting the standards to meeting the standards. And then the second step is a maintenance plan, which allows us to get the area redesignated officially to meeting the federal standards. With the attainment planning, basically we put together a unique plan for every pollutant for every area. And we do that through a local advisory committee that includes the local business, citizen, and local governments. And based on our ambient monitoring, we identify what the current air quality is. We identify what all the sources of pollutants are, and we present the advisory committee with options. And then the advisory committee helps us assemble a plan, and that plan is then adopted by the Environmental Quality Commission. So, for example, and this is where the basis of all of our air quality requirements come from, basically through these attainment plans. The plans will look at what we call point sources, area sources, and mobile sources. In water quality, you may be used to point and non-point. That's our equivalent jargon in air quality. So, for example, with point sources, the plans might identify emission standards for industry by industry category. We might also have requirements for new and expanding industry. For area sources, those are things like wood stoves, open burning, use of consumer products and paints and so forth. And then mobile sources are things like vehicle inspection, transit, oxygenated gasoline, things like that. Any combination of those we've put together for uniquely for an area, and those plans were very successful, so that by the mid-1990s, every one of our areas was monitoring air that actually met the standards. But that's not enough for EPA. We have to also show that we'll stay in attainment for 10 years before they'll let us redesignate an area to attainment. And that's to make sure it's not just a fluke that we didn't have an economic downturn or some unusual condition that led us to attaining the standards. So we put together maintenance plans. And the maintenance plans, like the attainment plans, we go city by city, pollutant by pollutant, and identify whether we need to do additional things to maintain the standards over the long term, considering growth, or whether there were some things that were in the original attainment plans that we no longer need. And both cases have happened. For example, in our carbon monoxide plans, we relied heavily on oxygenated gasoline. That's when you basically add ethanol to the gasoline. It reduces the carbon monoxide emissions. Well, car technology has changed, and now the cars don't need oxygenated gasoline to meet the carbon monoxide standard. That strategy was useful in cars that were made in the 1980s or earlier. It's not necessary for newer cars. We were able to eliminate that as we went through and did our carbon monoxide maintenance plans. On the other hand, for some pollutants like ozone in Portland, when we project out population growth in the future, we had to do quite a bit more, and that was the origin of our enhanced vehicle inspection program. And then, for example, in Jackson County, we had to do a little bit more with particulate. The Jackson County put together a uniform wood stove control program, consolidating the local programs that have already been in place. So through our maintenance planning effort, we're working through the state community by community and trying to bring areas back into an official maintenance designation. And that's important for several reasons. One is, obviously, it ensures long-term health for the citizens. But also it allows us to ease up on some of the growth restrictions that are imposed by the Clean Air Act. And in particular, for new and expanding industry, the requirements, once you have an approved maintenance plan, are much more flexible. In addition, for transportation planning, instead of having each transportation plan considered comparing what would happen if you build this plan versus don't build the plan, we're able to budget for transportation emissions in our plans. It's a much more efficient structure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a perception in my district among some folks, and I'm asking, I guess, for your help in explaining it, that in the achievement of the air quality standards for certain areas, there has been what I'm going to call, for lack of a better word, boundary creep to make the measurement area larger. And as a result of it, for small communities that are nearby to a large metropolitan area, if the metropolitan area is having difficulties meeting the standards, that the sort of boundary creep occurs, and all of a sudden smaller communities become part of fixing a metropolitan area's problems. Tell me that that's real, not real, completely haywire.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, you're probably referring to the expansion of the vehicle inspection boundary.
I might be.
That was part of the ozone maintenance plan for the Portland area, and the origin of that was when we looked at the vehicles that were causing the air pollution within the metro area. Many of those vehicles originate from the surrounding communities when people commute in for work, and so one of the strategies as of the Portland maintenance plan was to expand the vehicle inspection boundary to include the contiguous area around the Portland metro area. That doesn't occur in all of our maintenance plans. That was specific to that plan, and that was a recommendation of the local advisory committee.
Who's the local advisory committee comprised of?
In that case, it was actually designated as part of House Bill 2175 from the 1991 legislature. And it was a governor-appointed task force on motor vehicle emission reductions in the Portland area. It included representatives from the legislature, the local governments, the business community, environmental community, and it included county representatives. So pretty much everyone was at the table.
Madam Chair, one last question. What do you do in cases where, in an air attainment area, you span two states?
That's... Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, that's actually the case in Portland. Our non-attainment area for Portland includes Vancouver, Washington. In that case, we did joint planning with the air agency in Southwest Washington, which is called the Southwest Clean Air Agency. And we developed our plan together so that we determined jointly how much emission reduction was necessary, and then each side of the river achieved the same percentage reduction, although we used slightly different strategies, similar but slightly different strategies to get there.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
So continuing along, we have completed several of our maintenance plans. So we just said Portland, we completed the ozone and carbon monoxide maintenance plans. For Grants Pass, we completed particulate and carbon monoxide. For Medford, carbon monoxide, and Klamath Falls, both particulate and carbon monoxide. We've been working hard on Medford particulate for a number of years. We're getting close to finishing that. We expect to finish it soon. And then in the 0305 biennium, we'll be working on Lakeview, LeGrand, Eugene, Springfield, and we'll have to also get back to work on Portland. Those plans only last for 10 years, and when they expire, we have to do a second 10-year plan. So, as you can see, we've had great success in this area, but we still have a huge workload. It's really important that we get these maintenance plans done because it's good for economic development in the communities. And the local governments really appreciate having the non-attainment stigma removed, and they work hard with us on these plans, and they really appreciate when we actually get the clean air designation from EPA. A couple of other challenges under this goal are that EPA recently adopted two new ambient air quality standards, one for fine particulate, Stephanie defined yesterday, PM2.5, the very small particulate matter, and also they changed the ozone standard, so now instead of looking at one-hour time increments, we have to look over an eight-hour time increment. So far, we have not violated those standards. We have one concern where there's some forest fire impacts that we're trying to get an exception for. But we did have a number of areas that came close, and Stephanie mentioned them yesterday, several areas that have had exceedances that we're watching that are close to those standards. So those are just ongoing things for us to work on.
Andy, can you talk to us about with the ozone measuring requirements being changed, what's the net effect to the program?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
With the ozone measurement standards being changed, what does that mean in terms of how the program operates? Is anything different at all?
In our case, Representative Morgan, there probably won't be any change. In some parts of the country, it's a big change, and let me explain that. Ozone is not emitted directly. It's a photochemical reaction in the atmosphere that occurs between volatile organic compounds and nitrogen oxides. And it requires the presence of sunlight, which we don't have a lot of in the Portland area. So it's quite possible for us to violate the one-hour ozone standard where we can get a short peak. But when you look over an eight-hour period, typically we don't have a long enough period of hot, sunny weather that we will build up an eight-hour incident. We do have eight-hour incidents, but typically... the stringency for us is about the same, the eight-hour standard versus the one-hour standard. In a place like Los Angeles or Houston, It's a very different story where the 8-hour standard is much more stringent, and it's causing them to go back and redo all of their plans. For us, we think it's going to be about the same. If we continue implementing the standard, the strategies that we adopted for the 1-hour standard, we anticipate that that will keep us out of trouble with the 8-hour standard.
Is there an issue in an area like Medford where there is a lot more sunshine?
Yes, there is. And Medford's currently at the about 87% of the 8-hour standard. So we're watching it. As we have more population growth in that area, it is a concern. And that's one of the reasons that we've recently instituted a voluntary Clean Air Action Day program in Medford, comparable to the one that we've been doing for a number of years in Portland, where we anticipate, based on the weather forecast today, that we think we might have problem with ozone, and ask people to take the bus or carpool or other strategies like that.
So what happens when you have a fire situation like they had down there and all the biscuit fire smoke choked them out all summer long?
Representative Morgan, those fires caused a number of exceedances of the PM 2.5 standard, and enough in some area, in one area in Klamath Falls, where it would be classified as a violation if we can't get an exception from EPA. EPA has what they call a natural events policy, which allows us to accept events like that where it's not caused by human-caused pollution, and we don't expect that it's going to be a recurring kind of event. They haven't yet applied that policy to PM 2.5 because it's a new pollutant, so we're working hard with them to get that policy implemented. So as it stands right now, we had one violation of the PM 2.5 standard, but we don't think it's going to stick.
And the violation being the Klamath Falls issue because of smoke that must have come off the Silver Fire. That must have been a hummer of a violation. Representative Johnson, did you have a question?
Do fines accompany the violation, or other than they get fined?
Representative Johnson, when an area actually violates the PM 2.5 standard, or any of the standards, we would pick that up on our ambient monitors, and we're required by EPA for the PM 2.5 standard. Sometime this year, we'll have to submit to them which area, our data, and from that data, they'll be able to tell which areas violated the standards. They'll be officially designated non-attainment areas under federal law, and we'll have a certain amount of time to put together an attainment plan, and then a certain amount of time to come into attainment. So there's no automatic fines. But there is an automatic effect on industry, which is that new and expanding major industry will have to put on the most expensive control equipment, and also will be required to reduce existing emissions within the area equal to or greater than the amount they're adding, even though in those cases we think that primarily, well, most of the exceedances were from forest fires, and the remaining exceedances were primarily from wood stoves. So it's a situation we want to avoid. It would cause an economic development impact, and it wouldn't really be solving the problem.
Is EPA responsive to the waiver? I mean, it seems to me that this is a no-brainer. You have this giant fire, a huge air quality impact. It's a transient event and an act of God.
And it's another federal agency that's causing it.
That's right.
Yeah. How does that work out?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I think that EPA will be responsive, but the wheels turn slowly.
It is an interesting catch-22 to find the state stuck in, where we have to shut down industry to try to control a problem that shutting down industry isn't going to do anything at all to control. And I would hope that we could work those issues through without having to go to the private sector to try to solve what's clearly not their problem.
Madam Chair, I'd like to comment on that as a general dilemma. The fact of the matter isn't, because an analogy on the water side might be the TMDLs, because the analogy between point sources in air and point sources in water, and what we're calling area sources in air, like forest fires or wood stoves or whatever, and non-point sources in water, As far as the feds are concerned, the solution to the problem is the same. If pollution is coming from area mobile or non-point and areas that are, where it's more difficult to define and or the regulatory structure may not actually be able to have requirements on those folks, their only fallback is to ratchet down on the point source in industry. And as I was mentioning yesterday, in air, the pollution now is like 5 to 10% from industry, and by far the greater amount comes from automobiles and or from area sources, but the system is set up and the funding and everything else to really always fall back on the industrial sources. And one of the things that Andy and the air program has worked on over the last couple of years was what we referred to as an air toxics advisory committee to try and develop with the stakeholders a strategy in Oregon for how we're going to develop programs to handle pollution from those other sources so that the focus is not so much on industry. So it, even though the forest fire sort of exacerbates a particular problem, the generic problem still exists.
So what I hear you say then is that we're trying to modify our state programs to deal with the inability of the federal programs to deal with the non-point source issues?
To a certain extent, Representative Morgan, that's true. They at the federal level, it's not that the programs don't exist at all, but our challenge, I think, has been both in the water side and on the air side to figure out in each state, and the funding, quite frankly, we have gotten some federal funding, both on the air and water side, for those kinds of activities. But a lot of what you'll see in our budget discussions in general fund, particularly in Andy's program area mobile arena, you'll see quite a lot of general fund. I mean, our state has stepped up to the plate on that.
Thank you. Representative Krieger.
Just real quick, Madam Chair. How does Oak Ridge get in this situation? It seems like it's in a place you wouldn't have problem.
Primarily because it's a mountain valley community that suffers from inversions in the wintertime and relies heavily on wood stoves for heating.
Please proceed.
So moving along. Our second, and let me just say briefly, we have two policy packages, which I'll be talking about next, and both of them relate to this first goal, at least in part. Package 112 focuses on monitoring for fine particulate pollution, PM2.5, and package number 113, continued staffing for the vehicle inspection program. And I'll be going into that, and you can ask me questions about that in just a second. I'd like to go on to the second goal, reducing risk from air toxics, and I'll try and be a little bit more brief here. The current program relies primarily on standards that are adopted, federal standards that are adopted, that establish national emission requirements for major industry. And basically, EPA goes through industry category by category, adopts regulations. DEQ then puts those regulations in our permits and implements the program here, but the regulations come from EPA. And the goal is basically to provide a floor level of control across the whole country that's basically consistent. It's a 10-year effort that EPA is just finishing up. They're a little bit late, but they're catching up and going through basically all these categories. The problem is, as Director Halleck just said, most of the pollution does not come from the major industrial sources. And the federal program primarily focuses on adopting standards for major industry. In addition, it doesn't look at what happens, what's the cumulative effect of having a number of sources in a community. It also causes public concern to be focused more on the point sources than on where the pollution is really coming from, because we have our permit hearings and the federal standards applied to the permitted sources. And so this whole process can end up leading to delays in permitting, which is something that we've been trying to avoid. So about 5 years ago, we put together an advisory committee to try and address the situation. The committee included representatives from business, from the environmental community, citizens, neighborhood groups, health departments, local governments, and so forth, and came up with a program that really would focus on where the problem is, not where the perception of the problem is. We just finished that effort up, and we have a consensus recommendation from all those parties. And basically the program is designed to build based on science. We use monitoring and toxicology to say, is there a problem? Then we use emission inventory and modeling work to try and figure out what's causing the problem. And then we work on a community level to identify solutions. And it's designed to be implemented incrementally, so you won't see a slew of regulations coming out of this, but we will see hopefully some voluntary measures and some incremental approaches that will make progress on air toxics, looking mainly at air and mobile sources, because the industrial sources are already addressed by the federal national standards. So we're hoping that this is going to be helpful both from a public health standpoint and also from an economic development standpoint by taking the focus off of permitting. And this is the other half of Package 112, which provides us with federal resources for doing the science part of that program. The third goal is visibility, protecting visibility in our national parks and scenic areas, preventing deterioration. This is still on page one of tab five if you're following that. Basically, Oregon has 12 federally protected areas. We call them class one areas. They're Crater Lake National Park and then 11 wilderness areas. They're required to have visibility protection plans by EPA. The first round of visibility protection plans were adopted in 1986, and they focus mainly on Oregon-generated local air pollution. And mainly they look at the Willamette Valley Field Burning Program and the Oregon Department of Forestry Smoke Management Program. This comprises the bulk of the Visibility Protection Plan. There's a new federal requirement called Regional Haze, and it's considering the fact that actually visibility-causing emissions don't respect state lines. The entire West is working together on a Regional Haze Plan, so that the emissions from other states that affect Oregon and Oregon's emissions that affect other states will all be considered in a more comprehensive fashion. Our first submittal deadline for the regional haze rule is December of this year, of 2003. And we are currently working with stakeholders to try and figure out what type of an approach to take there. There are no policy packages associated with that. And then finally, I just want to mention...
So where's the money coming from for that program?
Well, EPA is funding all of the scientific work, Representative Morgan, through a Western organization that's made up of all the states in the West. And then the work of actually developing the rulemaking to incorporate it into Oregon rules is something that's built into our current planning budget.
So what do you anticipate that we're going to end up with in terms of rules?
Representative Morgan, I think that what we have in Oregon will satisfy the requirements of the Regional Haze Rule at least through 2008. Our program is already pretty well advanced. The Regional Haze Rule will focus on, for example, enhanced smoke management. In forestry burning, our program is pretty good already, maybe a few tweaks around the edges. It will focus on the components of it are looking at mobile sources. We're not going to have to do anything more with mobile sources. With point sources, we don't have significant point source emissions that contribute to regional haze. That's primarily from power plants, coal-fired power plants. We only have one in Oregon. And under the regional haze rule, we've developed a market trading program that will address that type of emission. So the short answer is that I don't think we're going to have to do anything other than account for what we've got, and that will carry us at least through 2008. So just wrapping up a little bit on program effectiveness and streamlining, I think you all know that in the air program we've done a lot to streamline our permitting program over the last several years, and we are now meeting a 90% timeliness target for issuing our permits. That exceeds the benchmark goal from benchmark number 10A, which was 85% on time. We're now at 90%. We're aiming for 100% as soon as we can get there. Over the last year, our emphasis was on expediting energy permitting. The legislature provided us with some additional resources for that. We received 25 applications for power plants, of which several are now on hold because the market has changed quite a bit. but we did have some really good successes in that area. One example was the Klamath expansion project, which we issued in just 60 days, which was a national record for a permit of that type. The normal time it would take would be at least a year, if not longer than a year. The PGE Port Westward permit was issued in just 7 months, as another example. And overall, we had over a dozen energy or other complex permits that required air quality modeling. Normally, we have three in a typical year. We had over a dozen last year, and we still met the timeliness targets and actually set some records. So thank you for those resources, which were, by the way, one time. We don't have them now. And then just a few other things we've done. Oh, well, and then in the coming biennium, we are going to be doing more streamlining. We're going to focus on the other half of our permitting program, which deals with the largest permitted facilities subject to the Title V program. Also in 0305, we'll be doing some more streamlining in our vehicle inspection program. We have three or four specific things we're considering right now. One is called clean screening, where we can identify vehicles that are clean enough that they will almost certainly pass the test and then exempt them from the test so they never have to come in and be tested. We are exploring the option of self-service testing. We would actually set up a self-service test lane in an area where the public could come and test their own vehicles. That would be open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We're developing some low-income assistance programs, and we're also going to be providing some additional DMV services. Right now, I think you know we offer registration at DMV registration. We're going to also be looking at title and trip permits at the test center. So just to give you a sense of some of the efficiencies coming.
Go back to page 26.
So back on page 26 of your presentation, there are two air quality policy packages. The first is called PM 2.5 Monitoring Network. There's two purposes to this package, as I mentioned. One is to continue the PM 2.5 monitoring that we've been doing for several years, and the other is to support the science portion of our air toxics program. This package is 100% funded by federal funds, and there are two different federal grants involved in the package. The first part of it deals with just the monitoring. And basically, the monitoring is how we determine what the pollution levels are. It's the basis for all of our planning. It supports required reporting to EPA. In the 99-01 biennium, EPA established the new PM 2.5 monitoring network. That, as I mentioned, the PM 2.5 is a new pollutant, and EPA. We didn't have any PM 2.5 monitors. EPA 100% funded that network. We didn't know how long they were going to be funding that, so we asked for 8 limited duration positions, and we received 8 limited duration positions. In 01-03, it became clear that EPA was going to permanently fund this work, but we didn't know at that time whether we would keep the same size network. We thought the network might get smaller, fewer monitors needed if we didn't have any non-attainment areas. So we asked for 4 permanent full-time positions and 4 limited duration positions, and that's what we received. And now, as it turns out, EPA is committed to the funding and also committed to the funding staying in each state. And they've told us that if we reduce our PM 2.5 monitoring network, they would expect us to shift the resources to other types of monitoring, whether it's toxics air toxics or other types of criteria pollutant monitoring. So they've committed that the money will stay in the states, and so on that basis we're requesting the last 4 positions be converted to permanent full-time. The second half of the package deals with the air toxics program. As I mentioned, air toxics are pollutants that cause serious health effects such as cancer and lung disease, heart disease. They're less understood than the traditional pollutants, and it's important for our program that we develop the science and base this program on good science. In the past, EPA has been funding the science portion of this program, but through a competitive grant process where each year we compete for a certain pot of money against Alaska, Idaho, and Washington. So year to year, we never knew exactly how much money we would get, and as a result, we relied on limited duration temporary positions and also on contracts. a few years ago, EPA committed to shifting less of the money in competitive grants and more of it into our base grant. And that is now happening for this biennium. So they're rolling the money into our base grant, which is provided to us by formula. We get an automatic percentage of it every year. Stable funding situation. So we're requesting now 3.5 permanent full-time positions. These would do toxicology, emission inventory, and also planning for the air toxics program. So in essence, the resources that we've had in the past through competitive grants, they've been limited duration and temporary resources, and now we're asking for positions. That's package number 112. And I could pause if you have questions.
Any questions? I need to blow a whistle or something. Everybody's going to sleep up there.
Trying to sell a joke, Stephanie.
That's good.
Okay.
Go ahead.
The only other air package is package 113.
Give me what page are we on?
You're still on page 26. And package 113 is vehicle inspection program staffing. And this package would continue existing limited duration vehicle inspectors that were approved last session, but at a lower level than the level that was approved last session. The package is 100% funded by vehicle inspection fees. And as I mentioned, vehicle inspection is an important part of the Portland Ozone Maintenance Plan. The package will be needed by us even if there is ultimately a decision to privatize the program, because it will take a certain amount of time to transition to a privatized program. The history of this package is that in 1997, we expanded the vehicle inspection program as part of the Ozone Maintenance Plan by adding a more sophisticated test. We call it the enhanced test. Because the test is more sophisticated, it takes longer. We need 3 inspectors in each lane, and I actually have a handout. Paul, do you have this handout? I have copies of it. The enhanced vehicle inspection program takes 3 inspectors in each test lane, whereas the old basic inspection program only took 1 inspector. So we had a large increase in FTEs needed. But over time, we're going to see that trend reverse, and that's what this chart shows. So let me just try and explain to you briefly. The slashed part of the bars is the enhanced test. That test applies to vehicles that were manufactured between 1981 and 1995. And as you can see, those bars get smaller over time. That's because people are trading in those cars for newer cars. So by the time we get to the 2009-11 biennium, there aren't very many 81 through 95 vehicles left on the road. The 1996 and newer vehicles are the growing part of the bar on the top part, and those are vehicles that are equipped with onboard diagnostics. And that's basically where the car's computer is keeping track of the emission system. And what we do is plug into the computer, download data, and it's a much faster and much more accurate test. So we're back to 1 inspector per lane. So as you can see, as we transition from the enhanced test to the OBD test, our staffing need will decline, and that's what's shown in the line on the chart. The other interesting thing about the chart is the bump down in 2005-07, and that's caused by a bill that was passed last session to allow initial registrations of vehicles to be for 4 years, right? So that means that that bill will that change goes into effect in the Portland area in 2004. So currently, there's a 2-year exemption from the vehicle inspection program, the first 2 years, and starting in 2004, that will increase to the first 4 years. So the first time you have to get your car tested is when it's 5 years old. That means in 2006. And in 2007, some people who were going to be tested won't be tested, and that's why there's a discontinuity there. So when you put all those things together, you can see what the staffing need for the program is, and it's declining. That brings me to this package. Last biennium, we requested 75 limited duration positions. This biennium, you can see, if you look at the 03-05 bar, we're down a little. We're asking for 70 positions. And then in the 05-07 position, we'll be down to 47 positions that we'll need. Now, in the end, we'll still have 20 of these positions that we'll need long-term. So in this current package, I've requested 20 permanent full-time positions and the other 50 to be limited duration positions. So I'll stop there. Director Halleck was mentioning about the vehicle inspection fee. This package is can be funded within the existing vehicle inspection fee. We don't anticipate needing to raise the vehicle inspection fee until 2007, based on our existing fund balance and spending levels.
I hesitate to bring this up, but we've all been lobbied on privatization of inspections. I haven't heard anything for the last 3 weeks, probably, or more. Can you update us what's going on?
Mr. Chair, as you know, we were required by budget note from last biennium to evaluate privatization. Based on that, together with Department of Administrative Services, we put out a request for proposals. We received bids from one company. Recently, Department of Administrative Services notified that company that their bids were not responsive to the RFP, meaning they didn't include some of the required elements of the RFP. So those particular bids are now no longer valid. But the study still provided us with a lot of good information about privatization. We have information about what at least one company would charge to run the program, comparable, similar to our program. We also have a lot of information about what would be involved in an oversight program that the state would have to run if we privatized, and we learned a lot about transition, how we move from a privatized to a non-privatized program. So there's a wealth of data that's been generated through those studies, and at this point, when the emergency board heard our report, they asked that we provide you with additional information about the budget, how it would look if it was privatized versus non-privatized, and I prepared that information, and Mr. Siebert's got that as well.
Let me pursue this a little further. What would it require legislation or e-board action or Ways and Means action to go out to activate this again? If the body wanted to go to bid again for RFP.
Can I respond to that? Mr. Chair, to our knowledge at this point, there has been no legislation introduced in this body with regard to privatizing this program. I understand there was some legislation that would direct the Secretary of State's Audit Division to review statewide the potential for privatizing a variety of programs, and I would presume if that bill passes that our program could be looked at in that review. So that the only discussion that is going on right now, to my knowledge about it, is in this subcommittee with regard to our budget, and I would presume if you wanted us to do further work on the privatization issue, that could again be in a budget note of some kind. Obviously, you all can introduce legislation as well. You can, of course, make any change that you might choose in our budget to direct us to either run the program with fewer people or charge less money or whatever it might be that you might want. But I think right now the only discussion that's going on is right here.
And I'm just trying to clarify the process in case the lobbyists get active again. Representative Morgan?
I really appreciate the work that the agency did over the interim on trying to deal with me grappling with this issue and the e-board having to deal with the issue too. But I kind of feel like we didn't take it to a complete resolution, that having the bids rejected by DAS kind of prematurely put an end to the discussion. And where my recollection was that we left off was that the agency was essentially going to do a bid on its own RFP. Can you talk to me about where that is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I know that that concept had been discussed, but we were never directed to do a second RFP. I think our view is that the RFP process isn't the most efficient way to evaluate privatization. It's in discussions with DAS, it's a very good tool for selecting a contractor, but in terms of studying whether or not we want to privatize, it's a cumbersome tool. So we could do another RFP. We could have DEQ bid on it, or we could do a study of another sort where we could get comparative information, whatever would be necessary to bring closure.
Can I have a follow-up?
In terms of your familiarity with what took place over the interim, the problem that I got into and the frustration that I ended up with was that there was no way to make an apples-to-apples comparison between the cost of the agency and the cost of privatization. So there could never be a substantive policy discussion based on real information about what was the best way to go. What would be your opinion about a way to come up with some kind of apples-to-apples type comparison so that policy discussion could be based on a platform of real data?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, my view is that we did have an apples-to-apples comparison. I know there were a lot of criticisms by the bidder of the process and specific points that were raised where the bidders felt that our evaluation didn't provide an apples-to-apples comparison. I did an exhaustive review of that with the help of my staff. I provided it to Mr. Siebert and went through point by point the issues that were raised by the bidder. And my feeling is that we do have an apples-to-apples comparison. I think the only way to take the next step would either, as you say, to do another RFP and have DEQ bid on it, although my feeling is we would likely get into the same questions again, or we could have some type of other process with an advisory committee or some other oversight process where we do an evaluation that's not fully directed by DEQ or an independent party is, although we had DAS this time, but an independent party more involved, so that people have confidence that we have an apples-to-apples comparison. It's a very complex program, and there's a lot of elements to it, so that it's easy to pick up one piece of it and say, well, that's different. The way DEQ runs it is different than what was required in the RFP. But we have to keep in mind that this bid covered a six-year time period, so we included in it things that we're doing now and things that we anticipate doing over the next 6 years, and our budget that we presented to compare the bids to included DEQ doing every one of those things that we required in the RFP. So a criticism that says DEQ requires something in the RFP that they're not doing just simply isn't true. Everything that we put in the RFP is something we're doing or budgeted currently to do. So I don't really know how else to bring closure to that.
Mr. Chair, is it your intention to go through this issue more finitely in work session?
I haven't fully made that decision at this point, but I think we should bring some kind of closure to it so at least we have some valuable
I think it would be a good exercise to get the apples-to-apples discussion on the record.
Mr. Chair, if I might just offer a suggestion. We can certainly talk about this between now and work session or whatever, but we've tried to think. I was actually heartened by the fact that there might be a bill coming out of the Secretary of State's or requesting the Secretary of State's Audit Division sort of look at this issue, because I do think, I would hope that the whole issue of the value of privatizing this program could be looked at as well as in the costs, yes, but all the rest of the issues surrounding the issue of privatization, the service, and all that kind of thing. And so if there could be during the interim or at some designated time that you might choose As Andy said, I also think it's important to have it be done by a body where folks are not thinking that there's too much DEQ influence or whatever it may be that they're thinking, that some committee could get set up, maybe even directed by one of you all to review all of this, and maybe in concert with Department of Administrative Services, that could be really helpful to just evaluate, let's look at this program, does it make sense to do this, and if it makes sense to do this, what ought the criteria to be before we go into yet another RFP process. And I'd be happy to work with you or discuss with you further on how that might happen.
I also think, as you said, Stephanie, it's important to see where this other bill is. Why would we be out doing our own thing if they're going to do the whole thing for all the other programs too? But I just need, for myself as a chair, I need to gather more information and figure out how we want to move forward.
And, Mr. Chair, the one other thing that I wanted to mention, if it came up, is, and if someone were to take a look at this or want a look to be taken, there is in statute 468A.370 that says that the Environmental Quality Commission already has the statutory authority to look at, the actual language says, upon finding that savings to the public and increased efficiency would result and the quality of the program would be adequately maintained, the commission, and that's the Environmental Quality Commission, may contract with a unit of local government or with a private individual, partnership, or corporation authorized to do business in the state of Oregon for the performance of tests or other services associated with conducting a motor vehicle pollution control system inspection program. So if an evaluation could be done or a request could be made to the commission, that might be another tool we could use here for this evaluation.
Representative Kruger.
The discussion we're having is one that had part of it 2 years ago, and we're having some more of it. And in the RFP, I get to thinking back about trying to get an equal comparison where President Morgan was going, look at wages and benefits, retirement. How do you put that all in the same? It seems like some things are kind of like in flux, and it's hard to get a true picture of it, but we need some system to have a better understanding of what it really means.
Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to work with you any way you'd like to address this.
Yep, appreciate it. Any other questions? Thank you.
Oh, Mr. Chair. All I was thinking about was I like the direction that you're heading that gets a question asked and answered definitively. I think back to last session and many sessions prior to that where studies were initiated to study Oregon Community and Economic Development. Never has one agency been so thoroughly studied at such breathtaking expense for no outcome. And I think that sometimes asking the same question over again and restudying it year after year after year doesn't make any sense. So I, and particularly in this budget environment, so I like your direction of saying let's get it asked and answered.
Okay. Thank you.
I would just like to point out, too, Mr. Chair, that over the discussions that took place this interim, there is a huge amount of information on this issue that's available already. And I'm not sure that we need to reinvent the wheel here.
Okay.
Good point.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, we'd move on to water quality if that's
sure.
Okay.
We've got about 18 minutes. We can get some work done.
We ought to be able to just whip right through that.
Wishful thinking.
Mike Llewellyn is going to join me here at the table, and the policy packages in my handout are on page 27, and I think Mike will probably refer, just as Andy did, to other areas of the binder for his discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mike Llewellyn, Division Administrator for the Water Quality Division. I'd like to also start out, like Andy did, with a brief overview of the water quality program, just to give a context to several of the policy packages that we'll be talking about in detail. Following up on Director Halleck's presentation yesterday on the history of DEQ, I noticed that there were a lot of questions about the relationship of federal programs and state programs, so I thought I'd start there in terms of water quality. In general terms, of course, our water quality program deals very comprehensively with all aspects of water quality, ranging from surface water to groundwater quality. We actually operate under state law with programs that various legislatures in the past have created. You know that we deal quite a bit with delegation of programs under the Clean Water Act that I'll talk about. We also manage small portions of the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. As you also know, in the past couple of years, have been brought in quite a bit to the Endangered Species Act in terms of the relationship of that act to water quality. So in terms of our breadth of coverage, we're dealing not only with surface and groundwater, but various legislative directives, both at the state and federal level. It might be helpful to think of in terms that if it's a surface water issue, meaning a river or a stream, lake, or the ocean, it probably falls under a federal statute, the Clean Water Act. If we're talking about groundwater, it probably falls under state law because, at least under the Clean Water Act, EPA does not have much authority to tell states how to manage groundwater quality. Now, there are a couple of exceptions, of course. One is actually the Safe Drinking Water Act, which requires states to implement a program called underground injection control, which basically means putting waste down a well where you could potentially pollute groundwater. That's a federal program that does have a nexus with groundwater. And we manage a program in conjunction with the Health Division called the Source Water Protection Program, which is essentially a technical assistance program with municipalities. I'll talk about a policy package later that helps municipalities protect their source of drinking water, in particular if it is groundwater. There's a nexus there. But in general, you can think of our responsibilities being driven in the surface water arena by federal law and on the groundwater arena by state law in general. Within the surface water context, as I think many of you know from previous discussions, we adopt water quality standards that set the environmental or health benchmark for how clean we want our waters. Those are adopted as a rule by the Environmental Quality Commission and submitted to EPA under the Clean Water Act for their approval. What's been made more complex in the past 6 or 7 years is if any of those standards relate to fish. There's a consultation process where either the National or NOAA Fisheries, as they're now called, or U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service have a consultation responsibility there. But the establishment of those standards is basically a function of DEQ in terms of its starting point. We do manage the wastewater program. As Stephanie mentioned, we manage about 4,000 permits, wastewater permits in the state of Oregon. About a third of those are actually federal permits, meaning they're NPDES, you may have heard that acronym, permits under the Clean Water Act. Land application permits, the acronym being WPCF, is a creature of state law. You're applying municipal or industrial waste on land. We manage, of course, the TMDL program under Section 303D of the Clean Water Act, and there's a policy package here that I'll talk about. We provide loans through the state revolving fund that Holly just mentioned. I might mention on that, there's been a lot of emphasis on describing that program as providing low-interest loans to municipalities, which is true. That's been the history of this program. We are about to present a rule to the Environmental Quality Commission next month, actually, that will expand the eligibility of that loan program to non-point sources as well, because we're trying to provide more revenue or more financial capability to address non-point source pollution along with municipal waste. The best example there...
Yes, Representative Morgan.
If you're going to add non-point source to the uses that that fund can be covered with, what impact is that going to have on the municipalities having to compete more for that money?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, it certainly will put more pressure on the system in terms of more demand. The counter to that, however, is we now are rotating through almost $50 to $60 million a year in loans, and that is actually going up every year because of the federal government continues to give us capitalization money to put into the system. Plus, we're now getting a lot of the original loan, principal and interest repayments back. So each year the pie grows. All we're really doing with the SRF expansion is making projects more eligible for a loan. I can't say yet what the demand is going to be from particularly the agricultural sector. I think one of the unique projects that we're working on is a low-interest loan program where we loan the money to Coos County, who is going to then run what I'll call a mini-loan program to provide low-interest loans for people to repair their on-site systems, as an example. There's several counties have approached us on that. I'm not hearing that there's going to be a tremendous demand on the part of, let's say, an individual farmer to take a loan from us for, let's say, like a manure lagoon or something. So I don't think in the big picture that the non-point source demand is going to pull all that much money away from the municipal arena, at least in the near term.
Can I have a follow-up? I know that we've had conversations in the past about the fact that there is no funding for economically disadvantaged people with failing septic systems, and that it is kind of a problem. But I'm curious about, is there currently excess capacity in the program to loan money out?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I don't know if this is a function of the economy, but right now we have about $90 million available for loans.
Okay, right, that hasn't been spoken for.
Not yet, and this is the first year. Somebody asked earlier, what percent of the loans do we get? Percent of that money do we get out? Historically, 100%, because the demand has been much greater. For whatever reason, right now we're finding it difficult to loan the money, and it may be that municipalities are just, because of their financial crisis and constraints, are not moving ahead on some of their infrastructure needs. So right now we have a tremendous capacity in the SRF program for some of these pilots like the Coos County on-site program.
May I follow up on that? Because I think Mike's hit on part of the problem, which is some of the communities can't afford to take the money. And there have been some discussions and I think some formal requests actually from some members of this body to the congressional delegation to have the fund looked at, again, it used to be a grant program. It used to be called the Construction Grants Program, and this money used to come to communities in the form of grants, not loans. And to look at the congressional level, again, at possibly at least making a portion of it come in grants, because the bigger problem is they can't afford to take the loan because they won't be able to pay it back. And this is a national problem.
Well, that has been the experience in my legislative district, that by the time the loans are all costed out and the repayment piece is in place, the cost to the people that use the service is way beyond what it's worth paying.
But that change, Representative Morgan, could only be made at the U.S. congressional level. There's really not a whole lot we can do about it, except, as we tried to do, maybe find some other uses for the money where people could afford to take the money so some projects can get done.
I want to clarify our response, Representative Johnson, then you can ask your question. In the Coos County's loan program, is that in place now, and is it acting, activated?
Mr. Chair, it is not in place yet. We've been working with them over about the last year to get that mechanism in place. One of the problems we're facing is the issue of lending the state's credit to a private individual. That's why we're actually going through a county, because we cannot loan money directly as a state agency. So Coos County is working with us on kind of figuring out all the bugs of this system. They will be definitely a pilot to figure out how this will work. So it's taken a little bit of time.
And if I recall, it's been at least 2 years that this has been talked about, and it's going to work. Part of the problem, we got to move and set up and go.
Okay.
Representative Johnson.
Under this program, would a private, not-for-profit water district be eligible?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, yes, if the project that we are loaning the money to is eligible in the terms of the scope of the project related to water quality.
This is an instance in my district where a private, not-for-profit water district has not been able to find a program that it fits under. And for the last 2 years, I've been struggling over at OECDD to try to find one of their programs that it fits under. And what I'm trying to figure out is whether or not any of the tools that you have in your toolbox are known to OECDD, and why it is my little private not-for-profit that serves 420 families struggles so hard to qualify anywhere. Drinking water.
Yeah, they're actually, Representative Johnson, there is a program that's an analogous program. It's called the Safe Drinking Water Act, SRF. It is administered by OECD. They may be running into the same problem in terms of they have to loan to a public entity. And then you'd have to figure out, is there a mechanism mm-hmm. where the money could be channeled through, let's say, a county, then to a private utility?
Well, what I'm trying to get to is, if you're opening yours up at all, is there an opportunity to look at these private water systems? The argument that I tried to mount to OECD was the 420 families on this little private system that serves a very rural area have no less call on clean water as anybody else, and I just keep running into the answer, you can't get there from here. I tried to amend a bill and had OECD jump all over me about that. And is all I want is those 420 families to have decent water.
Yeah.
I might have my fellow call you.
Yes, I'd be glad to.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Go ahead, Mike.
Just going to finish up on surface water very quickly. Senator Messler, I know that you're aware of the 401 program having to do with dredge and fill. We administer this 401 program both for dredge and fill operations as well as hydropower. Essentially, what a 401 program is anytime a federal agency permits an activity that could impact water quality, the state has to certify that that federal permit will basically be protective of water quality standards, and we administer that piece. With regard to groundwater, obviously the on-site sewage program is a creature of state law. It is not, there's no federal nexus there in terms of EPA oversight over the on-site program. I mentioned already the UIC program, which is this underground injection control, which is a Safe Drinking Water Act. We're delegated the responsibility to manage that program here in Oregon. Under state law, we manage the Groundwater Quality Management Act. That's a program where we work with local units of government and private entities where we find in particular violations of drinking water quality standards in the groundwater. We have two large projects that have been going on for about 10 years in this state on the east side, and we're working right now with some folks in the Junction City Coburg area, because of high nitrate levels there. This is a program where we provide a lot of technical assistance and support for local folks to deal with groundwater contamination, particularly as it relates to their drinking water supply. And then finally, under the Groundwater Act, under groundwater statutes, any municipal or industrial wastewater that is applied to land is managed through this WPCF permit that we administer. It's part of the 4,000 permits that I mentioned, but again, it is not a federally driven program. EPA does not have oversight over the WPCF program. That's entirely in our purview. Senator Messler, I thought before we, if you're ready, before I step into the policy packages, you asked yesterday a question about the TMDL mm-hmm. Criteria, and it's a nice segue if you're ready to get into the policy packages, since the first one's the Willamette.
Let me ask some of the questions. I've made notes here. Is it true that if we have a delisting of, say, the coastal coho, that the federal government would no longer require a consultation for permits in that area? Speaking of the Endangered Species Act, obviously.
Mr. Chair, my understanding would be that federal consultation would not be required if the action is in an area where there's no listings. So I'm assuming your question means there's no other listing, not just the coho. I believe the answer is yes to that. So as an example, EPA has been consulting on the approval of our TMDLs in basins where there are listed species. If we did have a basin where there are no longer listed species, then I don't see the nexus between EPA and the services consulting on a TMDL, because there's no legal reason to do that.
Okay. Let me move into another area, and this comes from the task forces I sat on with you, Mike, as past interim, as well as my own personal past experience. But is there equipment approved so that people can upgrade their systems where they need to, And is it approved? Is the equipment approved for multiple suppliers? So, you know, part of the problem with some of the equipment, there was only one supplier that was available. And I guess that also would speak to new technology that other states are offering. Where are we in that process? I know that's a very real concern of mine for the last 3 or 4 years.
Right. Senator Messerly, as far as I'm aware, right now there are no outstanding issues in terms of any of the unavailability of products where we were telling people you had to put something in, but then we turned around and said it's not available, it's not approved in the state of Oregon. To my knowledge, we've resolved all of that. We also, of course, have been dealing, and probably still will be dealing, unfortunately, with the alternative product approval for the drain field media. We recently approved a protocol for the Easy Drain product. After many, many years of entanglement around that. The downside, of course, is the other there's now another manufacturer, the third manufacturer on the scene, and the other manufacturer is bringing litigation against us for approving Easy Drain's product. So I'm afraid that we're still in a bit of a do loop on that front. With regard to innovative systems of treatment, one of the policy packages that I'll talk about is what's going on in the Lapine area, National Demonstration Project, where we've got about 16 to 18 very innovative treatment processes that have been tested and are ongoing testing. Those should be rolled out within the next 2 years as being available for product purchase here in the state of Oregon. And as you may know, with the on-site committee that we're looking at, we're going to try to streamline the permitting process where those types of facilities will not be needed to be covered under a WPCF permit anymore. We're going to get a much more streamlined permitting process to take that innovative technology out of a test mode and get it into day-to-day application in Oregon.
In your opinion, why has it taken so long to get this process put in a state where we can resolve some of these problems? I mean, I'm concerned that we've only got two suppliers, and they're in conflict because from the contacts I've had and some of the testimony we heard at the committee, it's a turf battle, it's a competition battle, and I think it's very unfortunate the state of Oregon got themselves in that box, particularly since the same equipment is approved in other states. So why have we got ourselves in this box, and how are we going to get out of it?
Well, Senator, if I may, I believe if you're referring, I assume, to the Easy Drain and Infiltrator.
Well,
as a
but there's other technology, too, that's available.
First of all, I think that the box that Oregon has been in is a box that many states have been in with these two manufacturers. This is not a unique situation in terms of this conflict going on in other parts of the country. It is. And now there is a third manufacturer who has already presented their protocol to our technical review committee, so there actually will be potentially a third manufacturer. And then, of course, you always have the fourth option, which is a traditional stone trench. I think, frankly, the issue has been, as you and I have talked many times, that part of this is an ethic issue of making sure that if the state is going to sanction a product, that we know that it's going to work because we incur some liability as approving products. Some of it has been just a difficulty of getting information from the manufacturers who have claimed that their product works and has been approved in other states, but when we've asked for actual data, we haven't gotten it, quite frankly. That said, I think we have put a tremendous emphasis in the last 6 months on trying to resolve this. And so, as I mentioned, we recently did, after a lot of discussion with our technical review committee, approved the Easy Drain protocol, so they're now moving ahead. But I think you're correct. It is a competitive environment with the firms that we're dealing with, and it seems if we approve one product, then the other firms are going to come in and they're going to want to try to become as competitive as the last guy in the door.
Senator, if I may just add, one of the dilemmas is that there is no national board for approval of this kind of thing that would help enormously. And I think you're quite right. I mean, the business of a state regulatory agency driving the market, if you will, by having to approve whether these products are appropriate or not is not a place that we would really like to be. It's been very difficult to find anyone else who would be willing to raise their hand and sign up for that responsibility in Oregon. We've talked to associations and people like that. So what we've been struggling with in the committee that you've been on is, as long as we have to retain this responsibility because we don't seem to be able to give it away to anybody else, how can we make it work better?
And I guess to go a little bit beyond that, I understand the difficulty in not having a national scoring system or approval system. But, you know, this has been going on a long time. Two points I want to restate again. That there are other states where they've been putting some of these systems in for some time. And it would seem to me that there ought to be ways to require bonding or something so that we could extend ourselves or extend more services to the state. The bottom line is we're trying to get better systems and more systems in to improve our water quality. If our process is holding that up, I think we really work hard at it. But through bonding or agreements or contracts or whatever, we ought to be able to allow some of these people to come in and prove themselves. And if it doesn't work, their bonding should pay to go back out and repair it for the consumer. But I think what I'm going to do, we're out of time for today, and Mike, if you'd like to pick up again tomorrow and finish up your portion, that'd be great. So with that, I'd like to adjourn the committee, adjourn the hearing, and adjourn the committee meeting.